back, session number 23216, reel 13.
Colonel Corbould, reel 13. You're in Aldershot as G1.
Right.
How did you do most of your business? Were you doing it by conference, face-to-face, or by telephone, or by paperwork? What was the...
All three. All three. I used to meet up with my various staff, like the training staff and the intelligence staff, every week, individually, as I did with the chap of the civil defence. Yes, it was, and the General Penfield, would have a weekly conference in his office, 9 o'clock every Wednesday morning. That was the drill, and all heads of branches were there. And it was a very good team indeed. We had a very good team, but of course we had this very wide parish which had to be visited a good deal.
What sort of things were going on in South East District when you were G1 that required your particular attention, went beyond the normal routine and things?
I think a great deal of this business of establishments, and also because we were up against all the time this wretched business of the Treasury. What do they call these people that used to come round?
Inspectorate of Establishments.
That's right. They were our bitter enemy. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of battle to do with them. That X unit should really be done away with. I mean, you refer to it as X unit should not be done away with. So then we had to sit down and write reams of paper about it and so on and so forth, which was very tedious.
Justifying every post.
Justifying every post, yes. Mm-hmm. That was the main bugbear.
That must have been very time-consuming.
Terribly time-consuming. Mm-hmm. But luckily I had some very good G2s, and I could offload onto them. I'd give them the direction, what would happen. They'd let me have the paper, and it was tomorrow morning. Then, of course, I'd go through it, having had my own ideas as well. But one couldn't do it all oneself. Of course one couldn't. But that's what you have G2s for. Whatever they call a G2 now, it's something totally different, I believe, now.
Now, you mentioned civil defence. Why did this suddenly become so important?
I think people were thinking in terms of being the Cold War, well, there might be some sort of nuclear bomb let off somewhere or other. And I think government-wise, they were a bit windy about it. And that's why this civil defence came very much to the fore in those days.
What kind of measures were you having to organise?
Well, it was mainly getting all these recruit units, like, for example, the Engineer Brigade, which was a training brigade, thinking out details of what they would have to do in the event of an eventuality like a nuclear bomb going off somewhere, or some nuclear device. These exercises, of course, always took place at the weekend, which is always very trying indeed. And we had about, I suppose, during the 2.5 years that I was there, I suppose we had about 4 of these exercises. But they did an immense amount of planning, and incorporating the civil defence people who would come to us, and we'd tell them our story, and they'd tell us their story, and we'd hatch out a plan.
Now, who were they? Were they local government officers?
Local government, yes, local government officers, yes, yes.
How did you find them to work with?
Sometimes they were very difficult indeed. They were very civil service-minded, they were bureaucrats. Everything had to be done by the book, you know, totally inflexible. And they couldn't understand. I remember one chap saying to one day, we don't understand you, sir, at all. You know, everything can be done in different ways. I said, well, of course it can. Any tactical problem, there are many solutions to it. They wouldn't understand that at all, however.
What about the ambulance service and the fire service? Were they involved?
Yeah, very
in
much involved as well, yes.
How did you get on with them?
Very well indeed.
Working colleagues?
Very, very well indeed. We, in fact, we had a fireman on our staff, a commissioned fireman, with a military cross.
But he would be part of the Ordnance Corps, wouldn't he? At that
no, time? he was wearing a fire service uniform.
Oh, was he?
Oh, yes.
So he was a civilian fireman.
Civilian fireman, yes. Mm. And he got himself an MC in the
but
war.
But we did in those days have a military fire service, didn't we, which was part of the Ordnance Corps at that time.
He was definitely a civilian fireman.
How had he won his MC?
I can't remember what it was now at all. He was a very nice man, and he was totally flexible.
What about the ambulance service? Were they?
Yeah, they were very good. Mm. And I used to leave them a good deal to the ADMS. He'd deal with the medical side. Mm. I'd work in with the ADMS as well, but they being so specialised, it had to be left really to them on the medical net.
Did this involve liaison or coordination with the Royal Observer Corps? Was that
no? I never came across the Royal Observer Corps at all. Mm. No. Were they still in existence? I suppose they were. I don't know.
I think they were. Yes, I think they were. They were going quite a long time.
No, I don't remember dealing with the Royal Observer Corps at all. I know who you mean, but no.
Did the WVS get involved?
Oh yes, they were involved. Yes.
Mm. What was their role normally?
Well, entirely for looking after the families.
Yes.
Providing teas and wads and all that sort of thing. You know. Very good indeed. Mm. The WRVS.
Yes.
As they became. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
You know, they were very good indeed. Yes, we had no problem with them at all. Mm. And indeed, we had no problem with the female units. We had a lot of WRAC, or yes, they were WRAC in those days. And we had a grade one staff officer, WRAC, in headquarters. And she was a very nice woman indeed. We had the WRAC staff college in those days. It was under our command. The WRAC depot at Guildford.
And there was the college in Bagshot, wasn't there? Or
oh, that was the Padres. That was the chaplain's
department.
Yes, yes, they were there. Yes, yes. Mm. Oh yes, you see, we had a senior chaplain in our headquarters as well, and he was the senior vicar, and a very nice man he was too.
You mentioned dealing with the police. What was that about?
Well, really, on the disciplinary side of who's going to control the civilian population in the event of something terrible happening. Mm. That was the main thing.
Presumably that should be primarily a civil police role.
Well, yes, but they were very keen, if the crowds got totally out of control, as to how we could come and play our part.
Would this be in the context of a disaster like a nuclear attack? Or
that sort of thing, yes, yes. It was all related to nuclear warfare or chemical warfare.
What were you supposed to do then? I mean, let's suppose the crowds did get out of control. Would it be riot drills, as it been used in earlier times?
Exactly. Rather like in India, you know, I had to do riot drills there when I was the adjutant of Bangalore. Yes, it was very much the same as that. Not to the extent of General Dyer or anything like that.
A much maligned man, General Dyer.
A much maligned man indeed, yes. I've got his book at home. He's probably in this library here. Mm-hmm. Read it. It's very well worth reading.
Yeah. Now, something else that was going on at the time was Northern Ireland was becoming rather more active.
Absolutely,
and dangerous.
Right. And ever after Bloody Sunday, too.
Yeah, presumably that had repercussions.
Very much so. We had on the...
What impact did it have?
Exactly. In February 1972... there was the most enormous explosion up in the parachute lines. And I saw this pillar of smoke going up. I knew in a second, terrorism. And so we swung into action, sealed off every road. I hurtled up on the flat feet. I could run a bit in those days, up to where this explosion had taken place, and the whole of one mess had been completely destroyed. Mm. Six people dead, one of whom was the Roman Catholic chaplain who just got back from Northern Ireland and had bought himself a new car. He just parked the car and off went the bomb, which had been standing out there for about 2 hours. And oddly enough, the blast was so terrible that it shot right across the back of this mess, parallel with the A325, and killed a gardener in working one of the gardens in Knollys Road or Knowles Road. Mm. That's blast for you. Four waitresses in the officer's mess were killed outright. And there was a scene of absolute carnage when I arrived. And all very unpleasant indeed. But we had to get things under control, which we did. And I immediately got on to the telephone and telephoned Southern Command and spoke to the Chief of Staff, to General Basil Eugster, who was the GOCNC. I said, we'd just been blown up, the Parachute Brigade. And the Parachute Brigade Commander, Tony Ward Booth by name, had the most lucky escape. He wasn't in his office. He was elsewhere in the building. Mm. And his office, where you're sitting, there's a great huge window behind, and the whole of that window came smashing through. Killed him outright. Chopped his head off, probably. So he was a very lucky man indeed. Mm. It was a very unpleasant situation indeed. And some 2 or 3 months later, they found the culprits. Early one morning, in North London, a policeman going along saw a man coming along, looking very suspicious indeed. And he stopped him and told him to open the parcel he was carrying, which was a sawn-off gun. He arrested him, and he was one of the chaps who... And then led to the other chap being arrested too. But they'd driven there and parked a car early one morning behind the mess in Scarpet.
You said that you sealed the thing off. I mean, had you introduced a counter-terrorist plan?
Oh, yes,
plan?
Yeah. Mm. I mean...
When has that been done? Has that been done in your time or before your time?
Oh, but before my time.
Before
I
your
took
time.
It over, yes. Mm. But I told the G2, I forget what the code word was now. Mm. Tell every unit. And we threw vehicles right across the middle of Queen's Avenue, mm. all the crossroads. It was all done in a flash. It was very good indeed.
It was this rat trap.
Yes. Mm. I think it was that, yes, yes. Mm.
What about precautionary measures to prevent terrorists from managing to infiltrate into military establishments in South East District? Had there been a plan for...
Well, there wasn't, actually. No. I mean, what do you do, Nigel? I mean, other than the normal security on the gates as we have now. Mm. If a chap's going to get in, he'll want to get in, he'll get in. If a lunatic can get into the Queen's bedroom, anything can happen.
I mean, that's true, because the army has always preferred to have its establishments open rather than behind high walls.
And, of course, all the barracks in all the cottages, you know, are open.
Yes. But things can be made more difficult by increasing the level of vigilance, can't it?
Well, yes. I mean, you have patrols going round, as we have in London now. Mm. People walking around armed around the edge of the barracks. Well, and during the days sometimes, too. Mm. But it wasn't quite so much in those days. This is 1971.
Well, the attack on the parachute brigade in Aldershot was really the first major incident in England, wasn't it?
It was, yes, mm. yes. Yes, it was. And
what were the repercussions then once, you know, the immediate dust had settled from this? And
well, the immediate thing was, I mean, people had to have... The military police came right to the fore and the SIB and so on. And, for example, we lived in a house in Kitchener Road. And because I was, by that time, in the parish regiment, I was told I had to have a police sergeant sleep in the house that night, which he duly did. And so all these precautions were taken immediately afterwards. But it was rather like, you know, shutting the stable off, the horse had bolted.
Well, better not to let another horse go through the same door.
That's right, it's quite true, yes, yes, yes. Which luckily didn't happen. Mm. But we thought perhaps there might be another one, because it's such a vast area in Aldershot. Mm. And so, yes, that was a very unpleasant experience indeed.
Who did you get to actually upgrade the counter-terror plan then? Did you do it personally, or was this a matter more for your intelligence section and their...
Well, the general would obviously approve it, but yes, I mean, it was done by our own headquarters. Mm. I mean, we had... And also based on the intelligence reports from MOD. Mm. MOD were totally amazed this thing had happened in Aldershot. They couldn't believe their ears at all. Mm. But I didn't deal with them. I dealt directly with Southern Command and let them tell...
Deal with MOD. Yeah. And now, of course, trying to improve precautions against terrorism also involves enhancing your liaison with the civil police, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, and we had an enormous amount to do with the civil police then.
Yes.
And I was continually down at Aldershot Police Station for about a week. So much so that in the end they said, do you mind not coming down? We want to take it over ourselves. So I got very politely the brush off. Mm.
But I mean, presumably you've got the various chief constables and the headquarters of the police in the various counties would be interested in this question.
We met regularly with all the chief constables in the general's office.
Ah.
I would think at least twice a year all the chief constables would appear, and we give them lunch in Government House, and we have a day's conference with them. They were a very jolly crowd of people, very nice people indeed. And it was very interesting to mix up with them.
Mm. What were they going to do for you then? Was there a division of interests and responsibilities?
Well, yes, I mean, we had these four counties, so, I mean, and they had their own plans all worked out together, which they told us about. It was just a question of really liaising and telling them what the military picture was.
Yes.
As much as we could to tell them. And... that was about how it all went away. It was a very close liaison indeed, very close. I hope it still exists. I hope so.
So, I mean, so you had a conference twice a year. What about...
Twice
a year.
Twice a year, that's right. Yeah,
what happened in between the conferences? How was contact maintained?
Oh, I used to keep in touch with the Deputy Chief Constable. Mm. I mean, I would think And I speak to the Deputy Chief Constable at least once a month on the telephone.
Would this be a sort of ad hoc and informal?
An ad hoc and informal, yes. Yeah. Mm. And of course, they'd invite me to go down there.
Yes.
I went to every one of the Chief Constable's headquarters about, I think I did it once a year, to each one. So there was very close liaison there indeed. And we kept up very close, too, with the ambulance service, as I said before, this is on the ADMS side, and with the fire service, too. Mm. Not so close as we did with the Chief Constables there.
Mm. Were there any other major incidents while you were G1?
Well, that was the major, terrorist incident, yes. The other bigger thing, of course, was the review of the Housing Division by the Queen in Long Valley, which was in 1972, when the Queen and Prince Philip, the Prince of Wales, Princess Anne, and the two small princes they were then, Prince Andrew and Prince Edward, all came, and there was a great lunch in Government House, and all the colonels of the Household Division, of each Guards Regiment, the two Household Cavalry and the 5 Foot Guards, all came as well. And this included, of course, Lord Mountbatten.
Presumably that must have caused some security implications.
It did, because on the morning of this, I was rung up at 4:30 in the morning by the duty officer to say that shots had been fired in Long Valley near the Royal Dais, and a Grenadier Guardsman had opened fire. There was some chap behaving in a very suspicious way, and he opened fire. He hit the car, but the car went. But he got about 2 figures of the car plate number, and by goodness me, by 9 o'clock they got the full number. The police, you see, swung into action as well. Right, this was the morning when the Queen and all the royal family were going to appear. So to cut a long story short, I was ordered to get hold of Brigadier Jones, who ran the engineer training brigade, and have them, all these recruits there, in the ditches around about the route which the Queen was going to take, which we did. And this was very unpopular with Prince Philip. And General Bernard Penfield got a very severe ticking off for being too security-minded. From Prince Philip.
Prince Philip has a reputation of wanting his security to be invisible.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Well, we were trying to get it invisible by having them in the ditches around about. But of course, being recruit soldiers, we must see the Queen, you know, so they suddenly appear. That was all the wrong thing. But still, there we are.
Who actually organised the ceremonial side of that?
This was done by a man called John Swinton. Who became the major general in London, Scots Guards chief. He was then the AG Minister, War Office then, and headquarters London District, my opposite number.
So you didn't have to get involved in sorting out that?
And not the actual things that was going to go on, but the security and all the administrative arrangements all came onto our plate, yes. And it was a joint invitation from GOC London District and GOC South East District.
What did the troops actually do during the course of the review?
It started off being early worldly. We had the Household Cavalry did some sort of charge. I think it was raised that their moonlight, the moonlight charge of the Household Cavalry, which is a very famous thing in Household Cavalry service. This was more or less done. And then there were all sorts, whether it was tactical demonstrations, and the whole thing opened with the Guards Parachute Company doing a drop. I don't know whether I'm thinking about it. Can you just turn that off for a moment? So, it was my job to meet all the colonels of the regiment as they arrived. And the last man to arrive, of course, was Lord Mountbatten. So I went forward in the Government House, and he said, "Good morning." I said, "Good morning, sir," and we shook hands. I said, "Would you very kindly sign the book?" "Oh, yes, rather." So he got up there, picked up the pen, and he turned to me and said, "How do I sign the book?" So I said, "Well, I suggest, sir, that you would sign it as you normally would. Perhaps you'd like to put Colonel of the Life Guards after." "Good idea." So this was done. And so off he went into the room, and the Queen, waiting for the Queen to arrive, which she did in due course. And it was my job after lunch to get all these cars lined up with the royal cars, the army board, and Old Elephanton Cobbley and all.
In order of precedence?
In order of the way that they were going to move off. So the royal cars were at the end of it, because all the other people were going first, you see, to get in position. So the front car, I said, "Right, we'll put Lord Mountbatten in the front car." This is all done weeks before. So out came Lord Arbat for lunch with the other colonels, and they got into their cars, and I was left with taking him on his own to the front car. And I honestly wanted Knights to travel on his own. So I opened the door. I'm not getting in that car. So I said, I'm very sorry, sir, but this is the car which has been allotted to it. I'm not going in it. And so with it, he put his cap on at a naval angle and stumped past me and went back to Government House. So I thought, a very rude saying, which I won't say on her at all, I'm not going to be done by this. So I overtook him, and I stood top in front of him in the entrance to the Government House. I said, I'm very sorry, sir, you will have to go in that car, and might I tell you that the Guards Parachute Company is due to drop in X number of minutes' time, and I've got to get this convoy moving. I must ask you, sir, please, to get in that car. And he stamped his foot like a naughty child. All right, he said. Turned away and stumped back in a flaming temper. I grabbed the car handle, the door, got him inside, not wearing a hat, stood to attention, and if looks could kill, I wouldn't be telling this story now. Then the amusing thing happened. The cars came forward, and in the next car was Field Marshal Templar, who, seeing me standing there, shaking with rage, wound down the window and said, well done, boy, well done, boy. That put things right as far as I was concerned. So that was my only conversation with Admiral of the Fleet, the Earl Lord Battle of Thurma.
Had you heard that he and Templar detested each other?
Yes, I heard that, yes. Mm. But you see, I was told afterwards that he was after going in the same car with the Queen, what he wanted to do. But while I was standing, blocking his view, blocking his passage, getting back into the Government House, the Queen walked behind me. And someone said to me, I think it was General Beauvoir, who was the Major General. He said, oh, he said, Bill, you ought to turn around and say to the Queen, and you're having Mountbatten trouble. And she'd have said, Uncle Dickie, do as you're told. But I wasn't going to do that. My name wasn't Beauvoir. Anyway, it was quite amusing.
And how did the rest of the day pass off?
Oh, very well. It all went off very well indeed. Yes.
So the Guards Parachute Company jumped.
They jumped
the
on time.
And then
all the whole thing took on from there, which John Swinton had laid on. And then there were various demonstrations in tents, cookers and people dressed up in Arctic kit. Mm. And the Queen went from tent to tent like this. And it was very good indeed. The whole thing went off frightfully well. And congratulations were sent all the way around. But I've dined out on that story with certain people. I'm very careful when I tell that story, Nigel. But as it's to do with my service, this what you're recording now, I don't think I've done any harm by telling this story.
I'm sure you haven't.
And the other day, the curator of the Guards Museum, a great friend of mine, David Horn by name, who lives in the same place in Amport where Bernard Penfield now lives, and something cropped up about Bill Corbould. Oh, he said, Bernard, I'll tell you a funny story about Bill Corbould. And this was a story which Bernard told David Horn.
We're not revealing any secrets.
No. So that was that. But those were the two big things. Mm. That one absolutely vile thing, and one very good thing indeed. Mm. And quasi-amusing, too.
What happened to you when you came to the end of your time at South East District?
Well, that was the thing. I then was coming to the end of my service.
Or was this on grounds of time? Well,
I was getting up upside then. I was 52. So I had to have, and I wasn't going to get promotion to full colonel. Mm. So one of our staff, Bob Lister by name, was sent off as a brigadier to some place in the War Office. And the last thing which Bernard Penfield said to Bob Lister was, get a good job for Bill Corbould. Mm. So I was then offered to go to Sennybridge as the commandant. Well, I'm very fond of training, and I like the country, so we all went down there. Mm. And that's where I finished my service.
But what did that job involve doing, being commandant at Sennybridge?
Well, the first thing was, when I reported to the general down there, General Woodrow, the Royal Corps Signals, and he said to me, I've got one thing to say to you. He said, pull the whole place up with the bootstraps, no more. Very good, sir, no problem at all.
What was wrong with it, then? Why did it need pulling up?
It had been let go and let go, and they'd had some funny sort of pastor of a major who'd been in command on. The whole place was in chaos. And so I had to start off from the word go. For example, the first thing I did was sack the quartermaster.
Oh.
He was sent on. He was sent packing.
What had he been up to?
Well, he hadn't been up to anything at all. I hadn't arrived there long, probably it was the Annual Administrative Inspection, as it was then called, and the ammunition was all up the spout. And so off he went. And I then found the most marvellous quartermaster, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, was available, and I got him in. And he got that all going there.
How did you find him? Did you hear about him?
On the grapevine.
On the grapevine.
And I had a most wonderful adjutant who was a retired officer called Bill Bedane of the Royal Ulster Rifles, who became a very great friend. And he was a wonderful man. He was one of the most professional junior officers I've ever met. Mm. For example, he'd won the Queen's Medal at Bisley for shooting, and would have won it 2 years on the go had his wife not been killed when she was on the way to see him get it the second time. So it was a good team I had there, and we had regiment after regiment coming down to train. And we had I had a gunner officer who ran all the gunnery side, and I had a range safety officer with range wardens. And it really, having to be supervised all the time, it ran on oil wheels eventually.
What were the main things that the battalions were doing? Was there this live firing?
Oh, yes, live firing. Oh, yes.
The main thing.
Very much so, yes. Mm. It was entirely live firing. Mm. And there was one particular place where the gunners could fire over the main road, which is a bit dangerous. And I was rather thinking that we ought to really do away with that particular gun emplacement. And I advised that before I left. Because I suddenly felt, what about if there's a fall short?
Quite.
Right in the middle of the road. Or on the village of Fuel.
Very serious risk.
Very serious risk indeed. Mm. I hope they've done away with that gun emplacement now, but I certainly recommended it.
Mm. Were there any unfortunate accidents while you were running the show?
No. We had to go into the impact area once a year and blow up all the different unexploded shells.
Unexploded ordnance. But there are always risks, aren't there, with live firing, that something will get in the way.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, now, one thing which did happen, I used to drive miles around this place, it was about 12 miles all the way around, regularly, and nearly every day if I could. And I suddenly came across, there was one range there where we used to do anti-tank firing. And there was a lot of unexploded wardens there. And there I see a woman and a child, all right up amongst all this sort of stuff, picking things up. So I rushed up there and gave this woman the most enormous rocket. So you realize you're putting yourself and your child at risk. This is a very dangerous area, and you must leave immediately. And if you don't, I shall send for the police. And anyway, lots of tears and so on and so forth, but she apologised very profusely. I said, I'm only doing it for your own good. Don't you ever appear on this range again.
What were they doing there?
I don't know, sightseeing. Picking up bits of metal and so on.
Well, was the range not fenced and marked?
That particular range, no. I mean, that particular range wasn't. With red flags flying.
Yes.
And but there was a bit.
I mean, there are occasional incidents, aren't there, with people straying onto range impact areas,
yes,
without realising what's going on. There was one at Purbright, wasn't there,
yes,
some
there
years
was.
Ago?
Yes, there was. You're quite right, yes, there was. Mm. But, I mean, this was a very well-marked hard impact area. There were red flags galore all over the place, and huge editors saying, keep out where red flags are flying, in white background, red letters. Mm. And we did all we could to make sure that these things were, instances not happen. But that was the nearest one we had.
Were you concerned with designing the training program on the range?
No,
or was that
it was entirely up to the battalion commander.
Done by the units themselves?
Yes. They said that they wanted to do. I then said which range that they would have.
Mm.
And after consultation with my gunner advisor and also with the range safety officer, etc. Yeah. It was very interesting indeed.
How long did it take you to actually raise it up and get it into good condition?
I would think about 6 months. Mm. Because there were other things that weren't going right at all. The food thing wasn't going right, and had to get a new messing officer. That sort of thing.
Sounds like you had to do a mass purge of many of the permanent staff.
And I made myself very unpopular with all the locals. Because some of these people lived locally, and they suddenly found themselves out, hadn't got a job. Well, I wanted a man who was efficient. It didn't matter to me. Eventually, I got a letter through the post